Hello, everyone, and welcome to another chapter of Librum of the DM. This is Chapter 5, where we'll be talking about illusions. Today, we have a special guest with us. We lost DM Saul, but we are adding in DM Marquis. Today's date is 4/28/2018. It is International Tabletop Day, so hopefully everybody's out there celebrating by playing a board game or two. I'd like to introduce DM Ed.
Yes, hello.
And DM Marquis.
Greetings.
So DM Marquis, tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right, sure. Well, over the last couple of weeks, I've just been getting caught up on the podcast. A lot to listen to and take notes on. And I run an adventure for the local game store because they were doing a convention, and it's called the Conquistadores. And then I'm preparing a lot of ideas for the Council of Worms game that I'm running for my family.
How long have you been gaming?
Oh, sadly, a long, long time, it seems. I've been gaming since the early 80s, so a long, long time.
Have you been a DM all that time, or how did you start off as a player?
Well, the first adventure I was in was a pre-generated one, and I did not like how it went. So I got my hands on the books and decided that I was going to start running them, because I just thought I could do a lot better at it.
Was your first adventures through the Dragonlance modules also?
Dragonlance hadn't quite come out yet. I started with basic D&D, actually.
I started off in first edition, but bumped back to basic for a while, and then slowly moved through the editions myself. All right, well, thanks for letting us know a little bit about you, and welcome to the show. Ed, what have you been doing lately?
Not a whole lot. The Roll20 game I'm usually in was actually canceled last week, because we didn't have anybody show up but myself and the DM. Other than that, it's just been my play-by-post gaming on the Unseen Servants website.
And Marquis, you said that you were working on your own adventures yourself, Council of Worms game?
Yes, I have been working on using the rules from the Council of Worms, but putting it in my own personal game world setting.
Yeah, I've been doing a little bit of work on my campaigns as well. My last Sunday game got canceled because of the weather. Thanks for snow and ice in April. And I've also played a game with my sons last Saturday. That one went really well. They were all excited to start again when they visited me again, so we'll work on that. I have a game tomorrow, so I've put together some notes, and I'm getting ready to do that. So now that you know what we've been up to, let's move on to our listener questions. Our first question comes from Dave Wagner. He is asking about encumbrance. Do we enforce encumbrance? And if so, which method do we use, the basic or specific? Marquis, why don't you go ahead and start us off on that one?
Sure. I actually use a spreadsheet for character sheets that has the option to do either. But more often than not, as long as people are carrying a reasonable amount of equipment, I'm not going to enforce the encumbrance all that much.
That is actually very similar for me, except I don't have the spreadsheet. I just, within reason, if they're not carrying more than what their maximum carry is, I don't really enforce encumbrance myself either.
I guess technically I do. I use the Core Rules expansion to keep track of all the characters, which automatically keeps track of encumbrance for you. Players know where to look. They know how to modify their character for the encumbrance. Their movement gets less. They can't do as much. So I let the Core Rules take care of it. I try to keep an eye on it. And, you know, if we're in game and they try to pick up something really heavy, I will kind of poke at them and say, you know, you might not be able to carry that very easily.
They might be able to lift it, but they might not be able to go anywhere.
Yeah, they'd have to drop it every time combat started.
Yeah, I have never used that particular program. Does it also keep track of weight by like the gold they're carrying or gems?
Everything that they attach to the character has a weight value, and it does accommodate for gems and money and anything they decide to pick up and throw on the character sheet.
So it sounds like it works just like my spreadsheet I made. Cool.
And it's a little less bookkeeping for me, and I always appreciate that. My characters will typically update every 2 to 3 gaming sessions, so they're never too far behind. But to answer his question of basic or specific, I really don't know which method the Core Rules uses. I've never looked at it too closely. So whatever method it uses, I use. So that was a nice, quick, easy answer to that one. Let's move on to our next question, which comes from Zachnefane Dwarden. Have you ever written a formal adventure? I co-wrote the first of a series of chronicles for Vampire, pre-generic World of Darkness, with a friend. My biggest struggle is the balance between how specific and detailed to make it and how open-ended to leave things. Yes, the vampire system is different and the setting is far more political than combat-based, but I would think the principles are similar. And since I use a lot of pre-made adventures as stepping stones, wrapping them in the campaign as the characters move around, I was thinking that I really should be writing more of my own. Ed, do you want to take this one?
Well, it's a pretty quick and short answer for me. No, I have not ever written any type of formal adventure.
I actually have several I have written, and I always encourage everyone to write as much as you can because it will make you a better player as well as a better GM. But I've posted quite a few of them to the internet on different places, most recently to the Google Plus communities. To me, they're kind of meant to be simple guidelines, a bullet point framework that you can work from and add to or subtract from as needed based on your character mix and players.
I myself have spent quite a bit of time looking through dungeon magazines and paging through some of the pre-written adventures, even some box sets for the Forgotten Realms, some of the standalones like Night Below, Under Mountain, Dragon Mountain. I know the format and I know the information that should be in a pre-written adventure. I unfortunately, all of my campaigns, when I write them, they are very bullet pointed, kind of like Marquise's. And I don't have anything that I would feel comfortable sharing with another DM unless I were able to go back and make some modifications and changes to format similar to those modules.
And I have had to do that at times when I wanted to publish them, go back and go over my notes from gameplay and make changes.
I think it takes a lot of time and effort to put something like that together. And even back in the day, I considered trying to put something together to send to Dungeon Magazine to see if they'd publish it. But I never quite got to that point, and I always wanted to move my game forward with my players rather than spend all my time writing up an adventure that I'd already run. I do have a lot of notes and bullet points from many of my campaigns in my gaming sessions, so I guess if anybody's interested, I could share some of those, but I don't have anything that is game-worthy out of the box.
And actually, I do have to correct myself. There was years back, I think probably 4 years ago, one of the D&D Google Plus communities had done a contest with a certain like word limit. And I did try and write up an adventure for it, but I didn't get anywhere. And there was only three of us that even entered.
And I was one of them.
So you guys both competed in the same contest?
That is correct.
I wouldn't call it more of a contest, though. It was fun writing it because I hadn't done it in so long. And it kind of got me to open up my 4x6 index and start looking to see what things I could do with it.
Maybe we'll have to host something like that on our site.
Well, it might be like our listener questions where we only get three people that actually say anything.
Then we'll get three awesome entries and we'll have some new adventures to run. Well, I think that answers that question. Thank you for submitting it. His next question is a settings question. Characters encountering canon heroes and villains. In Forgotten Realms, should the party stumble across Drizzt or cross blades with Alias or fall foul with Artemis? Or is that the GM equivalent of name dropping? When I ran games in the Forgotten Realms, I tended to keep the named characters out of the game for the most part, except early on. In my teens, I'm pretty sure my DMing style was very green and I stole a lot of ideas directly out of the books or out of the modules, which meant some of the secondary characters and NPCs appeared. I did use Elminster as a plot hook on several occasions, but I never included him in the game, minus giving the party something to do. I look back now, and I don't feel that it either helped nor hurt the adventure to include these characters. But now that I run my own world, I do have several named characters that everybody in my game world knows, and they do interact with the parties on occasion. I have a half-elf wizard who has a secondary class that nobody knows about that is doing his best to save my world, and he has interacted with my characters quite a bit.
I try not to use them that often or at all if I can avoid it. Although I have actually, I've thrown in Elminster in a game once. He gave the party magical items, which I'm thinking was probably not a good idea, but can't really unrace the past, you know. I have a character right now in a different game setting that said as an alias, since he's a rogue, that his name was one that's common in Forgotten Realms, Volo. I don't know if you're familiar with his guidebooks. That's who I'm pretending to be in a different setting where he doesn't even exist.
So you even call him Volo?
Yeah, I said my name is Volo with the first person that encountered me and tried to talk to me.
Are you trying to record all of the areas you're visiting?
No. I haven't said what I was doing, really. Traveling, mostly, is what I said.
I don't know that I consider including any of the canon characters as name-dropping. I look at it as using them as tools to run your adventure. Ed Greenwood even told people in an article that Elminster is there for the DM to use, He is whatever level you want him to be. He can be wherever you want him to be. He is just there to help the DM keep his party moving.
Well, I understand that, but personally, I don't use that particular setting, but I wouldn't have them meet any canon characters in any way. I think it really detracts from making the players and their group the focus of the game and being the central movers and shakers.
Probably depends on the party as well. Are they going to feel like something was taken away from them with this character appearing in front of them? And it probably depends on how the DM uses them. If you add a Drist to your party because he's going to help them out, suddenly the party's venture is not about them. It's about this character you've thrown into the adventure. To run across them and chat with them for a few minutes and then move on, I don't see that as being a huge detriment to the game.
Well, and as a player, I've had a canon character sort of dumped in on the group as the major villain that we fought. But we didn't actually know because he was only referred to as the Fat Man. And it turns out after the game was finished that the DM said, well, actually, that was based off of a villain that Ed Greenwood wrote about. I just altered him to my liking.
And basing characters and villains off of other characters in books or modules, I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, we're always stealing ideas from other sources to make our games better and more exciting. So I don't think that that was a bad thing. If he had made it that character and made him the main villain, that might have been a little bit different.
Yeah, and I've even done that with some of the characters I've made up. Like, I've got a mage who's called Odillo Lestrange, and he is quite strange. He has a pet pigeon that he feeds out of his mouth. He was based off of a character in Waterdeep that was a mage that ends up living in Undermountain and goes insane and kind of builds the whole labyrinth of, you know, Undermountain. Sort of similar to him, just on my own kind of, I guess you could say my own personality, sort of, if I was really odd.
So you're Hallister.
Sort of, yeah.
So that is our opinions on whether or not having canon heroes and villains appear in campaigns is a name-dropping event or not. Let us know what you guys think. We have added a special section to our podcast this week to accommodate our guest DM, and he said he would like to talk about running a game at a con, so we thought we would pass the mic over to him and let him talk about this a little bit.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Now, personally, I have played at conventions quite a few, and I've run a few of them, and as you said, you don't like railroady games, but that's what they are, basically. It has to be, because you're given a small number of characters that are tailored to a specific adventure, and then there's really no time for background or character building and motivation. And the other thing, they tend to be more role-playing with the R-O-L-L than role-playing with the R-O-L-E. So you throw lots of dice and use very few words. When I run them, I personally like to give players a slew of options with a basic idea of what the plot for the adventure is and backgrounds for the characters. And I try to make them as unique as possible because I find that people will enjoy it a lot more because you're playing with a bunch of strangers you've never met before.
That's one of the things that I look at that's a little intimidating is I suffer from anxiety when large groups of people are around. And when I get into a gaming convention, it's hard for me to want to sit down at a table. I have played in two games. Both of them were equally interesting. One was a very good role-playing excursion with very few combat encounters. The other one was a bunch of guys that were sitting around like they were playing Friday Night Campaign, and they were goofing around. They were just basically not focusing on the adventure.
Yeah, I've had that happen as well in some of the convention games that I've been in. And, you know, you got to be adaptable as a game master when you're doing that, so that way you can make sure it's fun for everyone, which is why I like using the bullet points to just give me an outline for an adventure.
Well, I think approaching a con game is different than approaching your Friday night campaign, Saturday morning campaign. You're going in with the focus of you're playing a game with a bunch of different people and you have an allotted amount of time. The railroady portion of this doesn't bother me as much because I know what the purpose of this is. It's not like you're running your campaign and, oh, you've got next week and the week after and whatever decision you make, you can go and do and you can adventure wherever you want. This one is a very specific adventure, and when you sit down at the table, you're signing up for this specific adventure. You know going in that you're going to have one quest that you have to do, and you have to get it done in that allotted amount of time. And I just think it was a little frustrating to me to see these players come to the table and ruin my experience. Luckily, I had already played the first one, so I knew that they could be good, But for a first-time player, sitting down at a table, joining a con game, you're going to get a little disappointed when the game makes it absolutely nowhere in a 3 to 4 hour amount of time.
Oh, yes. And that is a danger. When I was doing the convention a couple weeks ago with the Conquistadores, it was basically bullet pointed out, X, Y, and Z need to happen. They can happen in almost any order. And then it's a matter of directing the players to points A, B, and C, and getting them to the conclusion in a timely manner.
Do you think it's good to pre-run the adventure before you take it to a con to make sure it's going to fit in the allowed amount of time if the players are cooperative?
Oh, absolutely. I pre-ran it with the family just to make sure that it would work with the allotted time, which was only 2 hours. So I wanted to make sure I could get it done in 2 hours. Unfortunately, when I did run it, the people tended to kind of lag around a bit. And even though I was pushing them, they still took their time. Fortunately, they wanted to stick around for the second half of it, since I was running it twice. And it worked out quite well that time.
Yeah, I was thinking about this since we added it to the show notes, and I made a couple bullet points myself of what I think I would do. Never having done one before, I know what I would try. I would probably cut back almost all of my homebrew rules and make it more of a core game. I would cut back the skills and powers and play the core version of AD&D 2nd Edition. And I would probably drop my combat method and go for a more theater of the mind and maybe use a very limited amount of the playmats and miniatures.
Yeah, I personally don't like playmats and miniatures, so I don't use them, mainly because it's more stuff to buy and I don't really want to spend the money on it. And then secondly, because it tends to restrict your creativity at times. Now, for some people that like crunchier systems and want those, that's great. I've played in ones where I did have fun with that, and the person running it really thoroughly understood the mechanics of the game. And you have to when you're using those, I've noticed. But when you're doing theater of the mind, you can be a little more forgiving. And if someone comes up with something really creative, you can just alter the situation to fit that.
Allows the DM a little more creativity, as well as he can throw out a lot of descriptions and a lot of the way the battle's flowing. Like I had said in a previous episode, in a normal tabletop game, I got sick of explaining the thing over and over and over again. But if you go to a con and everybody knows they're only there for 3 or 4 hours and they're all paying attention, theater of the mind can work great.
Yeah, the only hard part is the noise level. For those of us with hearing loss, it makes it very difficult to make sure I can hear everyone at the table.
I can see where the distractions would get annoying, not just the sound, but all of the people moving about and people screaming back and forth and distracting the players as well.
Yes, that does tend to happen. Previously, last year, I did the convention as well, and that time I brought my six-year-old, and that was very difficult, so this time around, I did not bring her.
So that's a quick, brief take on cons and some suggestions that you can follow if you go to a con. If you are DMing a con, let us know and let us know how you prepare for it. Moving on to our next section, we have Pages of the DM. In this section, we'd like to talk about illusions and illusion spells. What are they? Marquis is going to read the section out of the Player's Handbook.
Thank you. That's page 108 of the Revised Player's Handbook. It talks about illusions. Of all the spells, those of the illusion school cause the most problems. Not that they are more difficult for your player to cast, but these spells are more difficult for you to roleplay and for your DM to adjudicate. Illusions rely on the idea of believability, which in turn relies on the situation and the state of mind of the victim. Your DM must determine this for NPCs, which is perhaps an easier job. You must roleplay this for your character. Spells of this school fall into two basic groups. Illusions are creations that manipulate light, color, shadow, sound, and sometimes even scent. Higher level illusions tap energy from other planes and are actually quasi-real, being woven of extra-dimensional energies by the caster. Common illusions create appearances. They cannot make a creature object look like nothing, like invisible, but they can conceal objects by making them look like something else.
Illusion spells have always been somewhat of a problem in my campaigns because everybody seems to have a varied opinion of what they should do. I have myself teeter-tottered back and forth on how I want to adjudicate them. I've come up with a system finally that I think is just very simple, basic, and based on the logic.
See, I suppose I've been fortunate because I haven't really had illusions used that often in any of the games that I've run. And I've only actually played in one game where there was actually an illusionist character playing along.
And I personally love playing illusionists and having illusions in my games. But the key for me is making sure to set expectations ahead of time with players as to what illusions can and cannot do.
That's something that I have described for one of our later sections coming up. Basically, looking at illusion spells, these are spells that are designed to make everyone believe in something that is not real. There's an article we'll discuss here a little later that will describe the different spells and how they can be applied as illusions. The idea behind the spells requires the players in my game to be very descriptive. What are they doing with the spell, and how believable are they making it? The School of Illusion is a very large school and can be employed very effectively when played well. If an illusionist is good enough, then they can create spell-like effects that can actually cause damage. If an illusionist has seen several fireballs, they can duplicate it with an illusion. If believed, those creatures would be required to make the standard saving throws and take whatever damage the spell would do. All that damage for illusions is temporary, but as long as they believe that the damage has been done, they suffer from it. For simplicity, I usually make the spell effect to whatever level the spellcaster is. So if they're trying to duplicate a lightning bolt, it's cast as a whatever level they are. So if they're fifth level, it casts as a fifth level lightning bolt.
Well, and actually some of the spells are pretty cool too, because you can even make like a room seem like it's really empty when it's not. Or you can make it so it sounds like something is making a noise from a different direction than where you actually are. If, say, you're trying to distract a foe or something of that nature.
Low-level illusion spells. Some are audible, some are visual. They don't cover many of the sensories until you get up to about fourth or fifth level, where a spell will include all of these in their description. So a low-level illusionist will have a better chance of being discovered casting a two-dimensional visual with no sound than a seventh or eighth level illusionist who can throw out some higher-level illusions that are more realistic. They have the sight, they have the smell, they have the sound.
Yeah, and some of them are even simple that they just really are meant to inflict fear and cause someone to run away.
One thing that I always try to make sure to do is when players are giving me a description, I want it to be very descriptive so that way I can visualize it myself. And if I can visualize it, then it's successful. And if I can't, then I would resort to rolling dice. That's just something I would prefer to do. I want players to really get involved with what's happening.
And that's the same way I do it as well. So it's really hard in my role to play an illusionist, because if they're not very good at being descriptive and they can't describe what they're trying to do very well, their spells are going to fail a lot and it'll make them a less effective character.
I understand that. I've had younger players have trouble with illusionists, and that's where, as a GM, it's your job to try and help guide them and give them a little more confidence in how to approach illusions.
So like if I said you see a pretty young lady clad in nothing but a veil and her underwear dancing over in the distance waving at you, would that be believable enough?
Depending on the state of mind of the players or the party, what they're trying to do, I would say yes, because in the distance you can't determine the sound very well.
How about in your world, Mike?
I would say that I would make that believable. Mostly because it is a fantasy world and it would not be the first time that something like this has happened. I would think they'd think it was more of a trap by a siren or a nymph rather than an illusion.
Well, and I could even see where illusions could be used as sort of like a security measure. Like if you're a mage that owns a magic shop, but you happen to be an illusionist, maybe you might have them as different alarm systems that alert you to when somebody's going where they're not supposed to be, or to protect something so they don't want to even go there because, hey, that looks like a displacer beast. I don't think I'm going back there.
Given that one, I do have in my game world a character whose name is Kadim, and he's a trader. He's also an illusionist, and his store has many, many things, but all of them are illusions until you actually buy something from him, and then he summons them to him with a special item that he has.
So you can't pickpocket any of his wondrous items?
Well, you can, but when you get outside, you'll realize you have a handful of snow.
Aha, very nice.
And actually, it wasn't until we came up with this theme for this episode, or chapter rather, that I actually incorporated an illusionist who owns a library in one of my play-by-post games. So one of the characters got left behind in a town while the others are doing a side quest, and he has now met the illusionist, is at the library, and he's chatting him up right now.
Yeah, I haven't had too many illusionists in my campaigns recently. I did way back in the day, but mostly everybody's going for the direct damage spells or the protective spells and basically ignoring the illusions.
Yeah, pretty much this guy has been somewhat out of practice, but I had just done some simple rolls, and he's basically a 12th level illusionist, but most of the illusions he uses are pertaining more along to the lines of his work, or to have a bell sound when you walk into his library, but there's actually no bell physically there.
So he's using the audible parts of the illusion to let him know when things are going on.
Yeah.
Well, I think that covers the basics of illusions. We're going to cover more a little bit later in the chapter. We're going to move on to our Pages of the Beast now, and we're going to talk about the Displacer Beast. He is found on page 56 of the Monster Manual. Ed, do you want to take his description for us?
They're very rare. They actually look a lot like a black panther with weird-looking tentacles that come off of its back. They're usually semi-intelligent, lawful evil. Number appearing is between 2 to 5. You would just roll a 1d4 plus 1. Armor class is 4. Movement 15. Hit dice 6. Thaco is 15. Number of attacks 2. Damage per attack is 2d4. Special defense is negative 2 on opponent's attack roll. Size is large. They're usually 8 to 12 feet long. Their morale is elite 13 to 14. Says they're also a pack. Very rare frequency. Temperate mountainous terrain is usually where you would encounter them. But it actually says in the description that it resembles a puma with two powerful black tentacles growing from its shoulders. It's very rare, and they stray far from human habitations. The Displacer Beast has a blue-blackish coloring of dark panther, and they look like a cat-like body and head. The females usually range from 8 to 9 feet and weigh 450 pounds. The males are 10 to 12 feet, 500 pounds. They have 6 legs, which would really throw you off a little bit. And the tentacles are tipped with a rough, horny edge or edges that can inflict terrible wounds, and their eyes glow bright green even after death.
That'd be a little strange to kill a Displacer Beast and still have it kind of staring at you with glowing eyes.
Yeah, I think that would make the players a little nervous, and they'd even be like, did we really kill it? Is this thing still alive? Let's poke it with a stick.
And I have had some characters do that before. They weren't sure if it was dead, and they kept poking it, the eyes kept glowing, and they basically left it alone because they weren't sure what to expect.
Yeah. One thing that is pretty good, though, is the XP value is 975, just for one.
So have you used these in any of your games?
I have actually never used them in a game, and I think they may have been used in a game that I played in, but I really can't remember off the top of my head which one it would have been.
I have actually used them, and I like them because they're a fun creature to bring down overconfident players. That displacement ability, while nice, isn't what I find more important. It's the teamwork that they tend to do. So they're pack creatures, so it's kind of like a wolf, only smarter.
And they're very angry at anything that's not a Displacer Beast. They will attack anything that they feel is going to be a good meal or a good victim.
And I had a player once have a ring of feline control that I forgot they had. And when they ran into the Displacer Beast, they put it on, and the Displacer Beast left them alone. And they said, hey, go follow those guys because they're tasty. And she had actually just robbed a thieves' guild of their treasury.
Well, and I actually forgot that's one of the key pieces as to why the Displacer Beast has a special defense. Is it almost like has mirror image on it. You have a hard time trying to even determine its true location.
There's a random roll in the description that talks about where he actually is compared to where the party will see him. So the party has to try to determine where is this beast compared to where I just swung.
Yeah, it says to determine the true position of the beast. You roll a 1d10, a 1 on 5. The illusion is in front of the creature. 6 to 7, it's to the creature's left. 8 to 9 is on the right. And a 10, the illusion is behind the beast's actual position. It also says that you cannot determine its location by dispelling magic or detect magic. You can only use the true seeing in order to reveal its position.
And I use this when I have Displacer Beast attack a party. I don't use them that often, but when they're in mountains or when they're in a hilly area, I will use them. And when the party attacks, I will determine where they actually are standing, and I'll make the party tell me what direction they're attacking. So the Displacer Beast could actually have its -2 until the party determines where it actually is, until they hit or until they've gone to the last location.
That's where area effects of spells are always handy.
Yeah, it doesn't matter then.
Although I have allowed a high-level ranger to track one in order to save the party, because they were getting slaughtered. And so he's like, hey, can I look at the ground and make sure the footprints match? And I'm like, I hadn't thought of that, so sure.
Yeah, and I don't even see that they mentioned anything about using a ranger's tracking ability in the description of it either.
Might be why they tend to mountainous areas, so they're harder to track because they don't leave footprints, not in their rocky terrain.
Yeah, this battle had moved into a ravine by that point, so I'm like, sure, you can track it, because if not, the party would have been lost, so I at least gave them a chance.
We'll call that one DM Mercy.
One of the things it mentions in the description is that they're also mortal enemies to the Blink Dogs. I've never been able to put this into a campaign for any good reason, but I would like to try to find a way to include this in one of my campaigns.
Yeah, they list it as an undying hatred of Blink Dogs. I've never used those before either.
Those are lawful good dogs that bounce around all over the place. They're basically the polar opposite of the Displacer Beast.
I have actually used Blink Dogs before, but they were more to help the party than, of course, harm them. I think at that time I had determined that the blinking ability messed with the displacement ability, and that's why they hated each other.
That's a good description for it.
I almost think it's that traditional cats always and dogs hate each other, you know?
It might be that simple. So that's our take on Displacer Beasts. Let us know if you've used them before or if you have any questions about them. Moving on to our next section, we're going to talk about the mirror image under the pages of the Spellcaster section. This is a second level illusionist mage spell that's on page 186 of the Revised Player's Handbook. And for people playing along like me with the Wizard Spell Compendium, it's volume 2, page 571. When a mirror image spell is invoked, the spellcaster causes from 2 to 8 exact duplicates of himself to come into being around him. These images do exactly what the wizard does. Since the spell causes a blurring and slight distortion when it's cast, it is impossible for opponents to be certain which are the illusions and which are the actual wizard. When an image is struck by melee or missile attack, magical or otherwise, it disappears, but any other existing images remain intact until struck. The remaining images appear to shift from round to round so that the actual wizard is struck during one round, he cannot be picked out from amongst his images the next. To determine the number of images that appear, you roll a 1d4 and add 1 for every 3 levels of experience the wizard has achieved, to a maximum of 8 images. At the end of the spell duration, all surviving images wink out. This is a kind of a fun spell, and I like the fact that the images shift so you never know which one the wizard is. Every round, I will have a wizard roll a die to determine which one he is, and I will determine randomly which one the monsters attack to see if he's even attacked at all.
This almost makes me think of like that cup and ball trick where you hide the ball under one cup and the magician moves it around and you got to figure out which one the ball is under. Well, it's kind of the same thing, just the mage is the ball.
That's actually a very accurate analogy.
But it's also a very useful defensive spell, I would say, for a mage, since you're already basically considered the squishy one, you know, as most mages are, because your AC typically doesn't get affected unless you have spells to lower it, because you can't wear armor, or if you have a really good dex score, and that lowers your AC that way. Otherwise, you have low hit points, high chance of getting hit because of your AC. All you got to do is stand in the background and cast spells. Well, now if you're forced into a melee confrontation, you've got mirror images.
I actually allow specialists to use the spell a little bit differently than a generalist can. Because the illusionist is a specialist, I let them have their duplicates do several different things in order to confuse the opponents even more. Because, to be honest, illusionists aren't as combative as some other wizards might be.
So if they roll 8 images, then all 8 images are doing something different?
They can choose to do that, or they can have them do all the same thing. They can also choose not to have the blurring effect happen each round, or they can choose to have it happen. And I only allow it because they are specialists, and they get to use it slightly differently. They understand that magic a lot more than a generalist.
Huh, that's an interesting concept. So do you do this for other specialists too then? So if you have an evocationist, do you let them do something special with their evocation spells?
Oh yeah, each specialist has different effects they can do within their own specialties. So that way you can end up with purple fireballs if you wanted.
Customizing the color of a fireball. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, actually, I like that.
I did that mainly to try and get people to play specialists, because most people were just playing generalists and it wasn't as much fun to say, hey, we've got the specialist here. He can do fun things, but no one's playing them.
So the mirror image spell, do you guys have a lot of players use it, or is it kind of one of those back burner spells that they're substituting for something a little more damaging or a little more defensive?
I don't know about my players, because I haven't really seen one use a mirror image spell yet. But as a player myself, with any of the mages I've created, usually I take mirror image as more of a defensive means, especially if I don't have a lot of offensive spells that I can use or that I was able to learn off of the rolls that I had to for learning spells.
I've rarely seen this spell used. Second level, I see strength spells, invisibility, web, but very few people take or use this spell.
I've had the opposite. I've had people take it almost all the time because they see how useful it could be in distracting their opponents while they run away.
Well, I don't get a lot of people playing spellcasters in my game, mostly because wizards are hated in my world and clerics are losing their powers, so...
So it's almost like playing in a magic dead land.
Pretty much. So, how have you used Mirror Image? How have your players used Mirror Image? Let us know at our email, librumofthedm@gmail.com. Let us know on our Google community page, or get a hold of us on Podomatic. Moving on to the footnotes section, we are going to talk today about It's All in the Details, an article written about illusions. This article is found in Dragon Magazine, issue number 222, and is found on pages 62 through 70.
And some of those pages are page-long ads.
Yeah, you found that a lot in the Dragon and Dungeon magazines. They would throw in ads right smack dab in the middle of an article, so you had to jump around the book. My personal favorite is when they said continued on page whatever, and you had to like flip through half the magazine to get to the rest of the article. This article I found was very interesting, but it's not one that I necessarily use. My concept of how to handle illusions is a little bit different. I remember the battle cry of, I choose to disbelieve, from many of my tables over the years. Still kind of stick with that method. I like the article. I read it many years ago. I try to incorporate a few small pieces of it. But in general, I try to play logically. And when I have an illusion against the party, I try to be as detailed as possible. And I try to give them clues that might make them believe it's not real.
I liked the article because it does give different perspectives of the challenges of illusions and how you can actually overcome them, though.
The description of illusions was great. It was far more in-depth than anything that came out of the player's handbook or the Dungeon Master's Guide. So I did appreciate that and kind of gave me some new perspectives on how to handle illusions. But as far as the rules that it goes over, I don't really use those.
Yeah, I hadn't actually read that article until you had sent it to me. And oddly, I've been doing most of that stuff and it's discussed in there for years. I like to secretly roll intelligence checks and they cast illusions, like a Phantasmal Force, and see if they missed any details that would give it away. And of course, I get bonuses for specialists because they're better at it. And if they give me a really good description, I'll probably just give them a bonus or waive the roll entirely.
And that's the fun thing about illusions. You go to 10 different DMs tables and they all seem to be handled a little bit differently.
Yeah, and I think I would actually use intelligence checks as well if I was ever to really run into a situation where somebody was playing an illusionist.
Well, I like the role-playing aspect over the ROLL playing aspect. I like to describe these things, and I like to see the moments of aha on my players' faces as they say, hey, that's not quite right, and then let them determine whether they want to disbelieve the illusion or not.
Oh, so like if I take my prior situation and change it so it's actually a kobold dressed like a woman waving at you, and you, as the player, decide, I don't think that's real. That seems odd. I could actually go, yeah, well, we're going to roll an intelligence check just to see if that's really what you think.
Yeah, that would allow the player to say, I don't think that's real. Roll the dice, and then they'd see through it. They would like, I see all of these indiscrepancies, so I know that this is not a real thing.
Yeah, I could see what you're saying there, but with the role-playing part of it, ROLE, if you give them enough rope, and they figure it out, I'm not going to make them roll. I'm going to say, all right, you guys figured it out. I find that aha can be taken away if they make a poor roll.
Well, what if the player's intelligence score is much lower than the actual person playing the character?
Then when they roll to disbelieve, they have a less chance of disbelieving it.
Yeah, that's where the person playing can be super intelligent in reality, but their character's got a really low intelligence score. Sorry, but even though you in reality disbelieve it, I think your character would be dumb enough to fall for it.
Well, I have played characters that were very not smart, and I would have them not even bother to roll for it. I'd be like, I'm attacking it, or doing whatever would be the appropriate response for that illusion. And I find that playing that role is more fun than trying to outwit the DM.
Well, is it outwitting the DM or just taking the situation and adjusting to it and figuring out what's going on?
Well, if I'm playing a character who's highly intelligent, of course he's going to try and manipulate it to his highest advantage. But if I'm playing a character who is not highly intelligent, he is not going to try and do that. So, like I said, it depends on the particular character and the role I'm playing.
Yeah, it's different if you're playing the town idiot versus maybe, you know, the town mage.
And I kind of let the players work together on something like that. If one of them notices something is a little bit off, if he decides to declare it to the rest of the group, they can all try to disbelieve.
Again, that's fair. And depending on the character I'm playing, I might have them actually go, okay, I believe you, or go, no, it's still there. I see it.
Yeah, especially if I'm playing the oaf. You guys can try all you want to convince me, but I'm still dead set in believing that that's there.
And so if they do believe the illusion is there, I still let the group do the combat, do the fight, and I will run it as a real creature that will just slowly vanish after they kill it. So this article is a really good read. I recommend everybody pick up a copy if they can find it and go through the article. It's very informative about how illusions are handled, and they do have a decent system on how to handle it. Even if you choose not to use it, maybe you can pull some ideas from it. Our next section is resources, and we are going to discuss the Complete Wizard's Handbook, the Illusionist section. The specialty mages were a great addition to the game. Moving from first to second edition, I appreciated the logic that if someone can be an illusionist class, why not also a specialist for each of the other types of magic? And so going into the Wizard's Handbook, they go into some nice detail about the different variety of specialists that are available in the game. The Player's Handbook did cover a brief description of how to handle that, but I did like the in-depthness that the Complete Wizard's Handbook went into for all the specialty classes, as well as expanding on the Illusionist.
Yes, because simply in the Player's Handbook, it just tells you a very small paragraph, basically, about Specialist Mage that specializes in illusions. You can't do any spells of these set schools because they're opposing for illusions, and, oh, by the way, you can't be anything more than a gnome or a human.
And I kind of put that rule aside, and I'll let anybody who can be a spellcaster play an illusionist.
I do the same as well in my games, but I also let players play wizards of other races that aren't normally them as well. Generally, though, they are unique for each player.
Well, and the illusionist also has an additional stat requirement. It needs to have a dexterity of 16, whereas the mage just requires intelligence of 9 or greater.
So an illusionist would need both a 9 and a 16 in order to be an illusionist.
Yeah.
When I have a player playing an illusionist, like I mentioned earlier, I have them get as descriptive as possible when they are trying to create their illusions. I just believe this adds to the role-playing aspect of it, and it allows me to see, are my monsters going to believe the illusion he's creating? If they do a good job describing the illusion, I will not even roll for the monster. They will believe it's there until the spell ends or until the logical conclusion comes to place and the illusion dies.
I also like that the illusionist specialist from the Wizard's Handbook gets a bunch of extra bonuses as they get higher in levels. That's always fun to bring into a game sometimes.
Yeah, so do you add them on top of your special rules or do these take the place of it?
Well, since you got to be like 18th through 20th level for them, they get those, but I haven't had very many people get that high of a level.
None of my parties make it that high either.
I've never had a game go much higher than probably level 6, I think.
My games usually fall apart around 10 to 12, if they even make it that far.
Yeah, same here.
Well, other than on some of the play-by-post games, they're higher level campaigns that some of the other DMs are running that I've actually been in, so I do have a like level 17 mage in one game. But that's just basically where I got to start out. I didn't get to play all the way up from level 1 to reach 17. It's just you're starting at 17.
Yeah, as a DM, if you have a group that never quite makes it past level 10, 11, or 12, it's fun to pull those adventures out once in a while and just say, hey, everybody roll up characters of this minimum level, and we'll go from there.
I've only done that a couple of times personally. And usually instead of a minimum level, I go, here's the maximum amount of XP that you guys have, and you get to divide it among magic items and levels.
I can't say I've ever had any characters start above level 3 in any of my games, but that's just because I've been playing the same world for so many years. I start them off and they're running the same campaign that I've been running for many, many years.
So the same campaign that I played in briefly.
That is correct. So on a closing note for me, I think the Illusionist is a great class. It is a great role-playing opportunity for my players. I won't let a brand new player play one until they've had another couple characters under their belt and they've played the game for a little bit of time to feel comfortable with it. The Illusionist is probably the hardest character to play in my world.
And I think Illusionist could be quite fun as well, but I probably wouldn't make them necessarily as hard to play.
Yeah, I don't necessarily go with them being hard. It's just that experience is definitely helpful in being descriptive enough to make it fun.
So what's your take on Illusionist from the Wizard Handbook? Let us know at liberabovethedm@gmail.com. Get a hold of us on our Google community page or leave us a message on Podomatic. Our next section is going to discuss the Gem of Seeing. This is the magic item that is found on page 528 of the Encyclopedia Magica. It's volume 2. It's also found in the Dungeon Master's Guide, and one of you guys will have to help me with the page number.
I found it. It's page 170.
The Gem of Seeing. These finely cut and polished stones are indistinguishable from ordinary jewelry, although detect magic will reveal their enchantment. When gazed through, the Gem of Seeing enables the user to detect all hidden, illusory, invisible, astral, ethereal, or out-of-phase objects within the viewing range. Peering through the crystal is time-consuming and tedious. The viewing range of the gem is 300 feet for a cursory scan if only large, obvious objects are being sought, 100 feet if only small things are to be seen. It requires one round to scan a 200-square-foot area in a cursory manner, two rounds to view a 100-square-foot area in a careful way. There is a 5% chance that each time the gem is used that the viewer sees a hallucination, something that is not there, or possibly some real objects as if it were an illusion.
And the funny thing about this is I believe they actually had this in one of the Dungeons & Dragons movies that were quite terrible in my opinion, but they used it.
That was the item snails look through to find things, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I really haven't played with the Gem of Seeing too much. I think one party has had it in the past, and they really didn't know what they had, used it very infrequently. I can see its benefits, and I can see how it could be used by a party, but I just have never really handed them out.
Right now, I have just one game that they did actually find one. But that was what my treasure generator came up with that was inside of the beast, so...
I do like that 5% of the time it backfires on people, so that's always going to be a fun role-playing time right there when they are convinced that something is real that is not, or is real when is not real when it is.
That is one of those DM roles I would make. I wouldn't let them roll for it. I would do it so I could determine whether or not how to describe it and what they're going to be up against.
Yeah, that's definitely one of those secret roles for a DM, behind the screen where they can't see.
Considering sometimes I'm quite pernicious, I might just not roll and tell them that they're seeing something they're not seeing, or the reverse.
Yeah, roll the dice and just pretend that they failed and give them whatever description you want.
While looking through it, you see this flying pig. What the?
So that's the Gem of Seeing. It's been used by all of us limitedly. If you have any stories about the Gem of Seeing, let us know. Moving on to our next section, we're going to go to the missing pages, and we're going to delve a little bit deeper into what are illusions. What makes an illusion real? How is damage from an illusion handled? And can a character die from an illusion?
Well, we kind of already did say what makes an illusion real is believability, for the most part.
So if a character believes that an illusion is real, how do you handle damage?
I think it would also depend upon what type of illusion it was.
So let's say an enemy shaman creates a troll as an illusion, and it's very realistic, and so the troll is moving forward. Everybody believes that it's there. How do you handle the damage from that troll?
I'm not really sure how I would handle the damage from that, because I thought the way it was listed in the references from the books, Player's Handbook mostly, is that illusions can't do any physical damage.
That is true. In my world, when an illusion is believed, the creature will attack or the ceiling will fall, and the players will believe that this is actually happening. They will take a mental damage. So when the illusion does damage, I'll roll for, say, the troll's claw attack, and that character will take X amount of damage, and that'll be temporary damage. But if they take enough, they might suffer a system shock roll when they drop to see if they actually believe that they were killed.
Yeah, I do something somewhat similar. Like the higher level illusions are really semi-real by their descriptions, but when the player is very descriptive, or if I have convinced the players that the illusion is real, they'll definitely take damage from it until they fall unconscious. And I keep track of all that illusory damage so they don't realize what's going on. And then even if there's obvious clues and they still miss it, I'll let them die. And those people will generally come back as a ghost.
Do they get to make any saves, or if they take enough damage, they're actually dead?
If they take enough damage and don't realize that it's an illusion, they're dead. And they start up another character, and I won't tell them that it was an illusion. I'll let them find out later when they run into their ghost.
The only thing different I do, well, I don't have them have ghosts, but I do let them roll a system shock to determine whether or not they believe they actually died. If they make their system shock, then they drop to the ground, they're unconscious for a while, and then they'll wake up realizing what happened.
So much like if you use the command spell and you tell something to die.
Yes, very similar to that.
What I'm talking about, though, is if an illusion is completely believed, and I've given them all the clues to let them know that it's not real, and they still miss it, then, because I've only had this happen twice, where they died of it, and I let them die, and they come back as a ghost, and it's mainly because the ghost can't let go of life because they died due to something that wasn't real. And so that gives me an opportunity to send the party on an adventure to avenge their fallen comrade.
That's actually a pretty interesting take on it. I think what I would probably do is, like, some of the illusion spells are meant to cause extreme fear. So, you know, somebody could actually have a panic attack and their heart could stop. So sure, I say a character could die from an illusion. And possibly I would adapt to Satendra's manner of saying, hey, they died of something not real. Now there's a ghost of their character.
I guess my take on illusions are a little bit different. I mean, if they die, they die, but I don't think I would have considered putting a ghost in place for them.
I can see how that could happen, but maybe not in all cases, so maybe that could just be like DM's discretion, or a DM could just come up with their own role for it and say, if you get this on a D10 roll, then yeah, there's a ghost of your character because you died due to an illusion.
Well, like I said, I've only had it happen twice, and it was mainly a way for me to bring closure to the characters, because the players were very upset that they lost one of their favorite characters. So I let them at least have a wake, as it were, for their character by avenging their death.
That is something that I might consider if it would help the character out. I've had several players that also were a little bit upset about the loss of their characters, so I do understand making accommodations for them.
Yeah, I've been one of those players before.
As have I when I was much, much younger.
Another thing about illusions is the disbelieving factor. We've already talked about how we make our rules and our roles. With me, the description in the book says that disbelieving illusion takes 1 minute, which means the character is standing there looking at the illusion and trying to disbelieve it. So in the process, if they stand there and the monster attacks, the book says that they automatically get hit and automatically take damage. I really didn't care much for this rule, so when I have a character trying to disbelieve an illusion, they're still going to react to the illusion coming at them, because until they're sure, they're going to have the same basic human instincts that anybody else does, and if something's coming towards your head, you're going to duck.
Well, this also kind of goes back to our trap chapter there, where there was even one trap where you believe that there's actually a pit trap there, and the character acts like they're falling into a pit trap. But everybody else that's not there is looking back at them flailing around on the ground perfectly fine. So you could actually do like a system shock roll due to damage from an illusion just to see if the player character really does take damage for real, or if it's just all in their head and, you know, they'll be fine once they wake up.
I take all illusionary damage as temporary. Eventually it'll wear off. They'll wake up one morning and like, oh, hey, look, I'm not actually injured.
Kind of like a long night out drinking at the tavern, right? They wake up the next morning with a headache and they're just like, what the hell happened?
Exactly.
I do the same kind of a thing as well.
I say, from my standpoint, I'm just using theoretical thinking of how I might do it just because I haven't and had that encounter yet.
I think the way I use is simple and based on descriptions and believability. So I like the way it works, and I let them have their intelligence rolls if they can find a way to disbelieve, and then we go from there.
For me, when I'm choosing to have players roll for disbelief, I give them bonuses depending on proficiencies they have, such as observation or alertness or awareness or some other one that would be similar, which would give them a bonus. And then I don't make them wait the whole minute because they've already been doing that as they are trained to do so.
Yeah, they don't stop trying to disbelieve just because the monster swung at them and they had a duck.
Exactly. They already are actively looking for things that aren't right if they have those proficiencies that give them that ability.
So that's our take on the realism of illusions and whether damage can be taken and how it's handled. Can a character die? I think we all agree, yes, they can die from an illusion. Moving on to our next section, we're going to talk about the illusionist class again and go into a little bit more on races that can play illusionists and how to handle those.
So illusionist class is in the player's handbook, but it's also in one of the additional splat books that we already talked about there, the Complete Wizard's Handbook. And isn't it also a kit in there?
There's no kits that are illusionist specific.
Okay.
There are actually some in the Complete Book of Gnomes and Halflings, though.
I did not use that as a reference point, so if you want to talk about those.
Sure, I can talk about those. There's actually just really three of them in there. You have the Image Maker. They're kind of like a super specialist in creating something out of nothing. And then you have the reverse of that, the Vanishers. And then the last one is called the Buffoon. It's kind of like a bard-like character for gnomes. So they use their illusions in a sly manner.
Yeah, I don't use gnomes in my world, so I never even thought to look at the gnome section of the Book of Gnomes and Halflings.
You're just a gnome hater.
The only thing they're good for is guarding my garden.
And I would do it vigilantly.
Personally, I use gnomes in my game world because they are the polar opposite of the goblins. And they tend to be necessary to offset some of the abilities I've given goblins in my game.
And I like to play gnomes and dwarves, so I allow them in all of the games I run as well.
And that might be why I'll allow any race to be an illusionist, because I know that that's taken away by getting rid of the gnome. So I will allow a half-elf, elf, or human to be an illusionist, or any other race for that matter, if the character can come up with a good enough reason why they would be one.
Yeah, I understand. In my game world, I don't follow that restriction as strongly because I allow just about every character race to become a wizard. They're just restricted in highest level they can reach.
I've even allowed halflings to be wizards in some cases, even though the book disallows it. The only race that I won't let be a wizard is a dwarf just because of their anti-magic stance.
Which is funny that you mention that because in some of the newer editions, they actually allow dwarves to be different magic casting classes.
I do allow dwarves, but they're few and far between, and more often than not, they're going to be a rune mage of some kind rather than a blow-you-up type of wizard.
Well, and that's one thing about dwarves, though, is they'll forge magic weapons and items, but they don't do any spell casting other than clerics.
That is the way it is in my world. The dwarves are very anti-magic, so they will go out of their way to avoid wizards. Theirs is a racial thing. It's not based on the reason why all the other races hate wizards in my world, but they don't like wizards. They don't like anybody who casts anything arcane, so they do tend to avoid them. And sometimes, if they're persistent, they will attack wizards.
And then you've got things like the Lord of the Rings, where you've got a dwarf traveling with people like an elf and a mage. Or even the Hobbit, where there's, 13 dwarves and a mage with a halfling or hobbit.
Well, Tolkien did a very nice job describing all of the races in his world, and I think a lot of people have adapted that as this is what a dwarf is, this is what an elf is. And in my world, I tweaked it a little bit. The elves aren't Tolkien elves, the dwarves aren't Tolkien dwarves, they're their own races and they have their own perceptions of things. So they are similar, but they do have their differences.
Terry Brooks also did a good job in trying to explain the differences between the different races, even though they all did descend from humans.
Yes, he did. I did like his take on how his world was portrayed and that it was like thousands of years in the future from our existing world. It was fun watching them come across a car and having Terry Brooks describe this rusted out heap. And it took me reading the paragraph twice to actually say, hey, he's talking about a car.
Yes, I really liked that as well. It took me a second read as well.
Well, and if you've seen any of the Shannara Chronicle TV show episodes, the way they even portray and have some of these other races look is way different from what you would have expected based on like Dungeons and Dragons or some of the other settings.
I was unaware that they actually made a television series. I'm going to have to check that out.
Believe it or not, it came out on MTV.
Yeah, MTV. They've done, I think, 2 or 3 seasons of it now.
Wow, that's very surprising. I don't own a television, so I had no idea.
Also available on Netflix for season 1, I believe.
I think they actually have 2 or 3 seasons of it now on Netflix.
There, MTV and Netflix. Take that free advertising. Getting back to the Illusionist class, sorry we got sidetracked there. The Complete Wizard's Handbook does a really nice job of expanding on what the Player's Handbook describes for Illusionists. I like their take on all of their specialist class. I like that they put specialists for every single type of magic. I encourage everybody to check it out and see what the Illusionist is all about and let us know how you guys play them.
I personally like most of what people call the splat books because they added those kits in there and I use them because I don't use the Player's Options rules, mainly because I don't own them. It was really nice to be able to personalize your specialist in some other way.
I liked most of the kits that these splat books came out with. There were only 1 or 2 out of the Wizard's Handbook that I've ever seen anybody actually use. Some of them seem more like they'd be more of a town body, so they would never go out adventuring.
Yeah, and that's fair. If you're doing an all-Wizards campaign, though, it would be helpful to use those, because I have done all-Fighters, all-Wizards, all-Bards, so on and so forth.
And if you do ever switch to the Skills and Powers Player's Options books, they do have all the kits that are adjusted for that system.
Yeah, that just require me to invest the money on it.
Well, there's a lot of good deals online. You could probably find something on eBay or Amazon that would be relatively cheap.
Yeah, and there's even some bookstores that have some of these older books for pretty decent on Amazon.
Yeah, I have seen them at the game store every so often, but it's a matter of convincing the wife to let me spend the money.
And that's the real trick. That's where you need to be in a wizard that can cast Charm Person spells and whatnot.
Yeah.
Or more like Charm Monster. Oh no, she's glaring at me.
Hopefully she doesn't listen to the podcast.
Or isn't listening to us recording.
She's looking at me right now with the evil eye.
So I think we should wrap up our episode here so we can let Satendra go challenge his wife to hand-to-hand combat.
Which I will lose.
Thank you for tuning in. We really appreciate all of our listeners. Keep those questions coming. We appreciate all of those. Our next episode is going to cover rogues. We're going to cover everything a rogue would do, from picking locks to detecting traps to anything that might be a little bit devious.
And even tools that they might use.
So join us next week. This is DM Mike saying, don't forget to look through your Gem of Seeing to check for those flying pigs.
And I'm DM Ed saying, may your illusions always be believable.
And I'm DM, this is Andrew Marquis, and I'm about to get my butt kicked by my wife.